This evening, I want to continue Tim's topic on the boundaries, those that are wholesome and the ones that may not be very useful. Just to start, I also want to acknowledge that I'm a white, privileged female in her 70s who's had a life with very few traumas. And I understand that I see this issue of boundaries through my own personal lens. And I acknowledge that there are others in our Sangha tonight who've had different experiences. And it is through that personal lens that they, you, may see this topic. So I offer my thoughts tonight with a desire that they are beneficial in your practice. And I hope that if you have some different perspectives, some different experiences, that you'll share them with the whole Sangha when during the Q&A and discussion time. So why do we practice? Why do we come together each week and sometimes several times a week to sit, listen to the Dharma, discuss our practice? Some say that we practice for freedom. Freedom from suffering, freeing the mind from suffering, freedom from clinging to things that don't bring us happiness. Others might say that we practice to understand the mind, to understand how the mind, heart, and body all work together in determining how we live. Another way to answer the question of why we practice is that we practice to find a skillful way of living our lives for mutual benefit and to reduce suffering, our own and in the wider world. And you probably have your own answer of why do you practice. So I hope you kind of keep that answer in mind as we explore this evening. The Buddha was so skillful in the use of words. There's not the good and bad in the suttas. There's words like wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful, wisdom and ignorance. And for tonight, I'd like us to think about boundaries, that the ones that govern our lives, in the context of whether they're beneficial to us and others, and whether they lead to freedom, connection, wisdom, compassion, whether they support us in our practice. You know, we're so fortunate in Sims. We get to come together several times a week, and we listen to not only Tim and Tuwari and the local Dharma leaders, but we've had five visiting teachers during our fundraising talks. And recently, Norman Fisher was the last visiting teacher to give a benefit talk for our Grow Our Dharma Roots fundraising campaign. And in the talk, he mentioned how the practice melts the ice in our heart and we become more tender. And I think the practice can help us become less defended, less stuck in old beliefs and old conditioning. The practice supports that ice melting. And boundaries are part of that process. Do they help us in our aspiration for being fully present in our lives? Or do they pull us back into that metaphoric freezer? Boundaries are a way of both saying yes and no. No, this is not okay, and it might harm me or another. But it's also a way of saying yes. This is okay. This is beneficial. This is consistent with my values. This supports me on my path and my practice. So tonight I want to talk about two aspects of this topic of boundaries. First, I've come up with four kind of guiding principles for us to consider as we look at boundaries and see which ones are beneficial and which ones are limiting. And then secondly, I'm going to take us a walk back through the year and over the 10 months that we've been studying Dharma and daily life and look at some of these topics and how we might be able to understand them through the lens of boundaries. So we've spent 10 months looking at Dharma in daily life. And I think, I mean, we all know that Tim and Tuwari are really smart, But I think they were really smart to put boundaries as the 11th month, because I think it's a really good time to kind of look back at those. In case you've forgotten what we have been doing all this year, the topics have been wealth and abundance, technology and social media, habits and patterns, the addictive mind, death and dying, emotions, relationships, devotional practices, social justice and engagement, and communication. But before we kind of jump into those 10 areas, I'm going to go over this kind of template for understanding some ways of seeing whether the boundaries we set are beneficial or limiting, whether they create safety and goodwill for us and others, or whether they help us avoid and resist dealing with whatever is in front of us. So I've come up with 4 guidelines or principles, and they're not presented in any kind of hierarchy. They're equally important. In my mind, you might have a different view. The first principle is, are the boundaries that we set rigid or flexible? Are they set for all time, or can they be changed as conditions change? And there's a number of ways to look at this issue of rigidity or flexibility. One way of looking at it is by looking at topics that are never talked about. Some are just kind of off limits. If you, like many people, are kind of, you might describe yourself as conflict averse, or, you know, I just want to get along and I want everybody to get along. Sometimes the way that manifests is that there's a whole bunch of things that you don't want to talk about. Money, child rearing, sex, politics, religion, you know, the list kind of goes on. There are 2 stories in my life about these taboo or no-no topics. The first one, I got married right out of college to my best friend. And after a couple of years, we moved to Connecticut and we went back to Chicago to visit his brother and sister-in-law. And I had met the brother a couple times, I think, at our wedding. And when we arrived at the house, there was this huge sign on the front door that said, "In the interest of family harmony, we will not discuss the following: politics, religion, money, and sex." And it was a very quiet weekend. You know, there was no fight, but there was also no connection. The rules they set out, the boundaries set out, they were so rigid that Steve and I we didn't really know what to talk about. You know, after you kind of talked about the weather and what the drive was like, it got pretty quiet. The second example of these no-no topics is a little more serious in my life. My older sister was born with a disability. It was called spina bifida. It's a condition where there's a hole at the base of the spine, and it can lead to mental limitations, urological, circulatory, and skeletal problems. Yet the word spina bifida was never mentioned in my house. I had no idea what was wrong with my sister, whom I loved. I knew she walked funny. Her hip was kind of bigger, kind of higher on one side than the other. I knew she was in the hospital a lot. But it was also clear that I wasn't supposed to ask what was wrong with Nancy. Everyone often described when Nancy went to the hospital that she was ill, but I realized later that she wasn't ill. She was dealing with the consequences of her disability. And because her disability was never stated, never acknowledged, there were a lot of consequences of that. For her, she didn't really get the direct support she could have benefited from her siblings, because we didn't really know what was going on. She was pretty isolated. We siblings were affected by not knowing what was going on, and we didn't know how to talk with her about what was happening. My mom created this boundary, and I believe out of love and a desire to protect us all. But as I grew up, I realized that it was really created mostly out of fear and ignorance. And it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s that I finally heard that word, spina bifida. So I wonder if in your families, in your lives, where there are also these taboo topics, so many families resist talking about aging, diminishment that comes with aging or death. And then all of a sudden, one of our parents or sibling or somebody is at the end of their life, and none of us know how to talk to each other about what is happening. I think we've all heard these stories of families like the person who's dying wants to be able to talk, and nobody wants to even listen because they're kind of, who knows why. But it's definitely these taboo topics. And it's not only with other people that there are certain topics that we refuse to talk about, but then there are the ones that we refuse to talk about within ourselves. You know, how much are each of us willing to understand impermanence through the lens of aging, diminishment, and death? So that's one of the ways of looking at boundaries that can be really rigid. Another way is to look at some of the beliefs and opinions that can be the foundation of boundaries we set. We all kind of, you know, we grow up and we come up with certain positions that we believe in. When I was in my 20s and 30s, I became an ardent feminist. A lot of us did. And I had no tolerance for any man using words like honey, dearie, sweetie, babe, whatever, you know, not allowed. But then in my 40s, I ran a recycling company and I used to drive truck for us. And we serviced 2,200 apartment buildings in the city. And some of them were really big. And most of these big apartment buildings were managed by semi-retired men in their 60s and 70s. So I'd pull up in my big truck and I'd start pulling the stuff out. And one of these men would come down and they'd, you know, want to talk. And they always asked if they could help me. And I'd always say, thank you, but no. And I was called sweetie, lovey, honey, dearie, just, you know, dozens and dozens of times. But I realized that these men were just coming from their background and what they always did in their lives. And they were not trying to be disrespectful. They were actually being friendly, a little flirty, but mostly friendly. So I wonder if for the rest of us, if we don't have those kinds of philosophical or political positions that we hold on to really strongly, and then we create boundaries out of them. Another way that sometimes we get these boundaries that are rigid is when we've had a really traumatic or really difficult event happen. When my partner Bill died suddenly 4 years ago, I could not be around certain people. It was too difficult. It was too emotional. And it took me months to understand what the boundary was that I was developing. And then it took me many, many more months to discuss with some friends who I had pushed away what was really going on. So sometimes we create these boundaries and they're really coming out of confusion. Another way that we can come up with rigid boundaries is through some of the language that we use. There's so many people in so many families where they've been labeled as overly sensitive, anxiety prone, fragile, aggressive, angry all the time, too passive. I mean, the list goes on. And sometimes these labels become boundaries in our lives, in our relationships and situations. No matter what happens, we get understood by these boundary labels. We get understood both by others and by ourselves. And here we are, almost 2 years into this pandemic. And what new boundaries have you set? You know, are you still working with the ones that we came up with in June of 2020? Although now we're all fully vaccinated, at least here, and I hope also out in Zoom land. And then those in our families and our work circles and friend circles, maybe too. But I don't know about you, but my Thanksgiving planning is very weird. You know, people are saying, I don't feel comfortable, even though everybody's vaccinated. I don't want to be inside. could we have Thanksgiving outside? Well, it's, you know, it's the end of November. So, you know, we're all dealing with this and trying to do the best we can. But sometimes we come up with these boundaries that are kind of fixed, like a now and forever kind of way. But boundaries aren't supposed to be fixed or permanent in that way. I love this quote from T.S. Eliot. He said, "For last year's words belong to last year's language, and next year's words await another voice. And to make an end is to make a beginning." We know in our practice, every moment is new. It's an essential truth of our practice. And I would like to suggest that we apply that truth as we look at the boundaries we set. So this first principle is, are the boundaries rigid or flexible? Are they open to be changed? The second principle is, are our boundaries aligned with our values? Are they aligned with the precepts and what we believe most importantly? Yesterday on the Sunday morning sit, one of the other local Dharma leaders, Jerry Harder, gave a lovely talk about boundaries. And they're all recorded, so you could go back and listen. He talked about our hierarchy of intentions and having sila be our uppermost intention. Sila, the Pali word for ethics that guide our lives. So Jerry urged us to keep sila at the very top tier of things. He defines sila as a guiding principle where all of our actions are for my benefit and the benefit of others, and that they lead to peace. Another way, you know, a way of keeping sila alive in our lives and in our practice is through the precepts. The precepts, the five precepts that we take at the beginning of every year together, and if you go on retreat, they're both a way of saying no, because they start with a refraining from, but they're also a way of saying yes. If you look at how Thich Nhat Hanh defines the precepts, he always starts with the no of the refrain, but then he adds a yes because he adds what he wants to cultivate. Years ago, I was at a Philip Moffat retreat where he encouraged us to rewrite the precepts and make them our own. So I started doing that, and I've continued kind of tweaking them so that they are really a clear understanding for me of what are my ethical underpinnings of my life. What do I truly value? And by the way, Philip will be here first weekend in December for both a Friday night talk and a weekend. So I started with my rewrite by taking the fourth precept and moving it into the number one position. And that fourth one was refraining from lying. Certainly to anyone else, but I made it most importantly not lying to myself about anything, as best as I am able, of course. And then with that not lying to myself as my backdrop, I worked my way through the precepts. Do no harm. Cultivate patience and pausing, not trusting that initial impulse to respond. Then I investigated that phrase, what does it mean that you refrain from taking anything that's not freely offered? What does freely offered really mean? How was I treating another person's time and space and interest? What kind of consumer am I in terms of what do I take of the resources that are available? I explored the precept about refraining from intoxicants that cloud the mind and really looked at all the different ways that I allow my mind to be clouded. How we allow our minds to be captured by social media, by busyness, by our phones, by the news, by you name it. And the last precept that I worked with, for 5 years, I was on the staff of a teen mindfulness retreat. And when we took the precepts with these teens, we translated this one on refraining from misusing your sexual energy to being really aware of and refraining from flirting. And it was a powerful experience for these young people. And it really has us under kind of looking at what kind of messages do we give out with our own sexual energy. So this second principle is, you know, are your boundaries really aligned with sila and the precepts? The third principle is, do your boundaries connect or isolate and separate? Do they connect us with others and the world around us, or do they contribute to greater separation? Do they support us being touched and affected by what is going on around us? There's a revered master in the Zen tradition, Dogen Zenji, who writes that enlightenment, or freedom, if you prefer that word, is intimacy with all things. That's pretty amazing, you know, to approach all things, all people, situations with a tender heart, with an openness. Of course, we need discernment and we have to make wise decisions. And it doesn't mean we don't have boundaries, but we ask ourselves, how can we become intimate with all things? That whole process being part of what it means to be free. I think the answer of how do we become intimate is by staying tender, by being open to being vulnerable in life, that we approach all things with that tender heart, with that heart where the ice has melted. We can change our view of boundaries that limit and separate to boundaries that expand and connect. And the fourth principle, which of course is probably the first, is that our boundaries have to be based in mindfulness and the practice and clear seeing, based in the teachings of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, the three poisons on greed, hatred, and delusion, the teachings on the three characteristics of anicca, dukkha, and anatta, that life is imperfect, impermanent, and impersonal. And this practice guides us in all of our lives. So the four principles are rigid or flexible and changeable, aligned with sila and the precepts, towards connection or isolation, and based in mindfulness. So now let's look at these 10 topics that we've spent this whole year fully engaged in Dharma and daily life. Wealth and abundance, that was the very first one. We were challenged to look at our beliefs about insufficiency and the role of money in our lives. We went back over the Eightfold Path and looked at wise livelihood. Are there jobs that you would never do? Are there certain jobs that you seek because of the image they project? You know, and what does that say about us? So before I ran a recycling company, I worked for about 8 years as a planner for the city of Seattle. And then for a variety of reasons, I resigned and I was pretty lost. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I took a job in a neighborhood deli making sandwiches and coffee. This is back at the kind of beginnings of when coffee was such a thing. And boy, was I a terrible barista. But in the first week or so, a city council member walked into the deli, and she was somebody that I had worked with for a long time when I was with the city. And I saw her in line and I ran into the bathroom, which of course was ridiculous because I was on the line and I needed to be making her sandwich. And I went into the bathroom and I looked in the mirror and I was just faced with this internal criticism that, look at you, you know, you went from being this mid-level manager at the city and now you're making lattes, you know. And I looked at myself and all these beliefs about what makes for success and failure were right there. And of course, I had to leave the bathroom. I couldn't just stay there for the rest of my shift. And she greeted me really warmly and asked how I was doing and all that. But I was so suffering from my own views and opinions about what work was valuable and what was not. It was a really good wake-up call for me. So wealth and abundance, a pretty juicy topic. The next one was technology and social media. And of course, I don't know where we would have been in these 2 years without technology and people like Cheryl who understands how to use it and that we can be together as a Sangha in this way. But we wanted to really be mindful of how we spend our time and all of our attachments to information, stimulation, entertainment, busyness. There's a whole continuum of beliefs around technology and social media. On the one end, there are people who every single newest tech device has to be obtained and used and checked as often as they can. And every time the phone makes its little beep, you got to go see what's happening. And on the other end of that continuum are people like my partner, Bill, who called himself a Luddite and thought all technology was bad. And whenever I had a problem with my computer, he always came in with his 5-pound sledgehammer to help me. But we're asked to examine kind of where are we on that continuum? What's our relationship with technology and social media? The third month was on habits and patterns. We revisited wise view and wise intentions. There are healthy habits and there are unhealthy habits. And looking at them and seeing as honestly as we can, what category do they fall into? Are these habits that lead to more suffering or are these habits that can reduce suffering? Habits, you know, can be created for safety for sure. But sometimes some of our habits are just these old beliefs and opinions that are just reified or concretized in our lives. So we're really encouraged to use our practice and bring curiosity and investigation. The next month was on the addictive mind. You know, I think Tiwary, when she was teaching that particular month, she started with this statement that we humans are of the nature to get attached. You know, just let that settle. I mean, it's not like we did something wrong because we got attached. We are of the nature to get attached. But just like with technology, we can get so addicted to stimulation and busyness and all of the things in our lives that we really lose sight of what's going on. We investigated the nature of preferences and how preferences can really become boundaries without examining them closely. There's a wonderful Buddhist teacher who also teaches in the recovery movement. His name is Kevin Griffin. And he said that the opposite of addiction is connection, not sobriety. So our kinds of addiction, the addictive mind often isolates us and separates us. The next month we spent with death and dying. And this, of course, is one of those that I mentioned earlier where we often avoid or deny. Many families seem to have a pact to avoid talking about it. In my family, one of the gifts that Bill gave to me and my son and niece was that he didn't have any taboo topics. So early on in our relationship, and when Pete was, I think, only 13 or 14, Bill said when he died, he wanted his body fed to the fish out in the ocean. He didn't want to be cremated and then have the ashes go there. He wanted his body to be food for the fish. So because he was so open about that, a few years before he died, we looked into, is this even legal? Can you just go do that? Well, it turns out it is. And there's all these rules about it. And so when he died suddenly, we were able to fulfill his wish. We got his body to a mortuary in Long Beach, and we put it on a boat out of El Waco. We went out about 15 miles and dumped his body in a 25-foot area that is designated. This is news to many people. It's designated for this process where you can dump bodies into the ocean. Being willing to look at our death and dying allows us to really prepare mindfully. You know, so often we set boundaries about for ourselves about it, and we just put off and put off. The next month, we talked about emotions, another really tricky area when it comes to setting boundaries that are based on emotions. It's tricky because if we believe that the emotions that are up are telling the whole truth about a situation, when often it's that they're just arising from conditions and beliefs and habits. But when we believe the emotion, we might create a boundary that is not very skillful. What about all those times when our buttons get pushed or we push someone else's buttons? Do we just go with how irritated we are or upset and create a boundary between us and the other person? Or do we remember that beneficial boundaries are based in mutual respect with a desire to connect? So we pause. Yep, we get triggered. We all get triggered. But perhaps instead of doing anything, of creating any boundary, of creating something, a fixed rule, this person pushed my buttons and therefore, what, you know, we're not going to have one kind of relationship. We pause until we can really figure out through mindful investigation what's going on. The next month was on relationships, an arena where we're often really quick to judge and, accept or reject. A couple years after Bill died, I started exploring the world of internet dating, which is a whole world of creating judgments based on very little information. I would go out for coffee or for a walk with somebody, and in an hour, it was like, no, too short, talk too much, wasn't spiritual enough, whatever, those little boxes that they encourage you to fill out, whether literally or in your minds. And then a few months ago, I listened to this podcast where they interviewed a man who was introduced as an expert on friendships. I don't exactly know how one becomes that, but he was an expert. And he said that it takes a minimum of 200 hours of connection to build a strong friendship. So here I was in the course of an hour and a half, saying yay or nay to somebody based on these little bits and snippets of experience. Well, I'm happy to admit that I've changed my ways. And although it's still weird to meet people that way, I'm giving them and myself a lot of room. When we were talking that whole month about relationships, one of the talks I gave at the Sunday sit, I quoted this wonderful Zen teacher, Ezra Beda. His book, At Home in the Muddy Waters, is a wonderful book. And he talks about relationships being the muddy water we swim in. So when you're in muddy water, you have to be really cautious about the boundaries that you create. The next one was on devotional practices and rituals. At one of the Sunday sits, four of us gave little mini talks because two of us were really into devotional practices and two of us really hated them. And we realized that those preferences were just either what we were used to or kind of how we came into this world. Some people, like me, I've always loved rituals and devotional stuff. Who knows why? I mean, it's just kind of like in my DNA. But at the end of that, after we heard everybody's experiences, we all committed to just exploring this arena and trying to step outside of just that history and habit and look at them with some new eyes. The next month, we talked about social justice and social engagement. And here's another one of those arenas where we often avoid dealing with the issues in front of us, like race. As Tim pointed out, I guess it was maybe 4 to 6 weeks ago where he gave a talk on racism, and he said that the work for white people that was before us was to take the first step in dealing with issues as they really appear. Many of us in our Sangha have been working with Ruth King's book, Mindful of Race. And the very first thing that Ruth asks of us is a commitment to being uncomfortable. Being uncomfortable is not an excuse for refusing to deal with something. And those of us who've been practicing for a long time know that. I mean, if we didn't feel okay with being uncomfortable, we probably wouldn't go on retreats. Or, you know, sometimes sitting for 40 minutes can be really uncomfortable. But around race, we wonder, why do we avoid this topic? Are we afraid of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing or looking stupid or being labeled as this or that? And when we go back to that principle of Sila, and what is the using Sila as our highest intention, we realize that it's way more important to live a life aligned with our values than follow that smallness of those ego-based fears. And then last month, we talked about communication. Again, there are those taboo topics, those no-nos that we never really talk about. And by holding on to that list of those topics that we don't want to talk about, it's a way of really continuing the divisiveness in our communities. And instead of avoiding the topic, maybe we could actually learn how to talk and listen to each other and come together with some more connection and understanding based in mutual respect. So boundaries, four principles, rigid or flexible and changeable, aligned with Sila and our precepts, connecting us with others, not keeping us separate and isolated, and based in our practice and in mindfulness. So let me just summarize a little bit in the last couple minutes that I have left. Wholesome boundaries. They're declarations of mutual respect. They're invitations for closeness, for honesty, for connection and safety. And they're created in the present tense, in the present circumstance. Setting them and keeping them can be really uncomfortable, especially if you're dealing with a difficult person and for the first time you have to figure out what are your boundaries with that person. They're a manifestation of our values, of what's important in life. And true, wholesome, skillful boundaries create opportunities for true intimacy. One of the things Jerry said yesterday in his talk was how when boundaries are really wholesome and beneficial, they're an act of generosity to yourself and to others. Because when they're really clear and of true benefit, they offer clarity, honesty, kindness, no games. We're not going to do harm to others. We're not going to let them do harm to us. We're being really clear and honest. Other people can trust us then, and we don't do things that we later regret. You know, we ask ourselves as we're looking at boundaries, that whole thing, we often use this phrase when we do the metta phrases, may I be safe and protected. Well, what, asking ourselves, do I need protection in this situation? And if yes, how much? Are there things I can do to stay safe and stay open? Can I understand discomfort as a response to conditions and then go back to Sila? To what's really mutually benefit and leads to peace. We can ask ourselves as we're looking at boundaries, what's the state of our hearts? Are we back in that freezer? Is our hearts ice or liquid? Is there tenderness or defensiveness? Are we fully engaged? Setting and keeping boundaries and reviewing them and reflecting on them to see whether they're still useful is not an easy process. So when Narayan Levinson was here giving the benefit talk, she introduced me anyway to a term I hadn't heard before, Dharma siblings. That's all us. We're all Dharma siblings. And I would encourage people to really explore this topic with a Dharma sibling or two, because sometimes it's hard to see clearly those boundaries that we've set that we're so attached to, and that we can't really see whether they're still being beneficial. And lastly, you know, where I started is, why do we practice? So do our boundaries really feed our desire for freedom? Do they help us in that aspiration found in the answer to the question of why do we practice? Thank you for your attention. So Tim usually offers a homework or a question for reflection between now and next week. And what I would encourage you to look at is to really do kind of a review of the boundaries that are active in your life. And are they being beneficial? Are they really serving you in your practice and in your life? If the four principles that I outlined are helpful, reflect on those. See what you discover. And we now have time for responses, questions, stories, and we can kind of take turns between those of us in the room physically together and those of us on Zoom. So anything at all that comes up in your own minds about boundaries. And if you're in the room, there's a microphone over there. And on Zoom, I think you can unmute yourself. And at the bottom of your screen is a way of raising your hand, if that is something that's useful. Who did? Oh, good. Hi, Lauren. You're still muted. Oh, still muted, Lauren. There you are. Now you're good.
Okay. Okay.
Hold on for 1 second. I'm learning something.
Okay. Well, taking what Jerry said yesterday at Sunday Sit, and then adding your example of the redoing the precepts, you know, it sounds like you really spent a lot of thought and time even reordering the sequence, and that impressed me quite a bit. And it also feels to me that aligning the boundaries with my values is really, really important. So that's my homework. I'm going to try that precept, really focusing on those and reflecting, you know, how they be for me.
Thank you, Lauren. I think in so many ways in the practice and in the teachings, making them really real for us. And sometimes that means, you know, you take some of the words of the Buddha or the words of the teachers and make them so that they're really real and alive. And it was a fabulous practice for me. The precepts are definitely alive for me. Thank you. Quieter group tonight. Oh, Deb, please come up. Do I turn off this time too? Okay. Okay.
No, I have to kneel down in front of you, Sue, so I can talk on this microphone. I can sit down too. Because a boundary is my knees hurt. Yeah. I thought it was really interesting when you were talking about the boundary with technology and social media. You know, I'm home during the day all the time, and I find that there are moments when just out of a lack of mindfulness, or I'm a little bit bored. I'll see what's on my phone or what's going on Facebook, or and then, you know, so much time goes by because I'm down this rabbit hole of looking at stuff that really is not very important to me at all. Does it matter? No, hardly. Did I have a fulfilling life before Facebook was invented? Yes. Can I remember that very well? No. So it's very interesting, the intrusion that I have allowed social media to take over, or the fact that news is instant. And I really have thought a lot lately about, well, how much do I really want to engage with it? You know, it's a choice. Mm-hmm. And I can set that boundary far or near. And what would happen if I didn't look at the news for 24 hours, if I didn't really pay much attention to it? And would I still consider myself to be an involved and responsible citizen of this country? Mm-hmm. And all kinds of assumptions like that that I've made about watching the news, or connecting with people, or how do I handle boredom when it comes along, which is not very often. I'm not a bored person, but you know, you can just mm-hmm. sort of mindlessly just sort of trip into it if you're not being very careful about it. Mm-hmm. So it's a very interesting subject. And I thank you for reminding me of it.
Oh, you're welcome.
It is useful. Yeah.
It is. And I think your story is probably repeated by a lot of us, of that just kind of mindless, oh, I'm already at the computer, you know, what's happening? I start with the, you know, the New York Times summary. And so then I feel that's good. But then there's all this other garbage that's there. And I've heard a lot of teachers encourage students to take a news break for more than just 24 hours, but to really see what happens, you know, for a week. You know, what happens if we don't know what has happened? And just to pay attention to, just like you were saying, the questions that are coming up for you, you know, what is boredom? What does that really mean? And it's not as if, you know, we're not arhants, and so we're not going to be necessarily mindful and productive and on our game every minute. But the more that we can be, you know, ask these kinds of questions. And that's what I think is so helpful, is to be asking the questions, you know, what's the benefit here? You know, what am I allowing to capture my mind? What's the consequence of it? What happens with that when I do it over and over? How do I feel? What happens in my body when I do that? You know, just asking ourselves those kinds of questions. Remember a couple of years ago when Rodney, this was before the pandemic, and we did a non-residential weekend at Nalanda West, and it was all about investigation. Just a slew of questions to be asking about our lives. I don't think he talked about technology and social media so much, but it's the same process. So thanks for bringing that up. This has been a rich year, I think, in terms of Dharma and daily life and all of these different topics that we've been looking at. Next year is going to be pretty exciting too. It's the ox herding stories, which will be really interesting. And next month is the eight worldly winds, which is also a wonderful topic. Anyone on Zoom?
Kathy and then Jackie.
Oh, great. Yeah. I'll turn my mic off.
So, Suze, I was really quite arrested by your first proposition, are my boundaries flexible or rigid? That's not the way I was raised. If I confuse boundaries with rules, it can get kind of thorny, but I'd like to think that I have, can you hear me okay? Okay. I'd like to think that I understand boundaries as being something between me and something I don't want, or that will protect me, or that I will find comfortable. And to have that be a flexible area is just really interesting. It's just a super new investigation for me in a way, even though I keep going over these things year in, year out. But the idea that I could make room in my boundary for love, you know, for some exceptional situation or some person who doesn't fit what I think is okay, but clearly, you know, this is the situation I'm in right now, and so forth. So I'm kind of excited about what the future might hold. So thank you for stating that way. It was helpful.
I realize I don't have to comment on everything that comes up because that was just well said. And, you know, I really found as I started looking at boundaries that there were just some that, you know, it's kind of like my little bag of boundaries that I keep, you know. And when was the last time I even thought about it? Is this still, you know, still true and beneficial and present? And is it an accurate representation of where I want to be today? So thanks, Kathy. Have a good time with that. Jackie, go ahead.
Thanks. Yeah. I've been doing something similar to what you've been doing in terms of rewriting the precepts and really making them my own to a precept of not killing. I mean, I am reasonably sure that I'm not going to go out and kill someone. On the other hand, I'm not going to refrain from swatting a mosquito. So what does not killing mean to me? And reflection on that has been, I think, really useful. And it's funny how the precepts kind of flow into each other, too, because when I'm thinking of what it means not to take life, it flows into what it means to not take that which isn't given. They all kind of support each other and strengthen each other and seem to kind of be the same thing. That's been useful to me. So thanks for bringing that up to remind me about that. I've been doing that as well. Thanks.
One of those, along with not taking life, I'm a gardener. And it's so interesting the relationship that we get with bugs. And some bugs that we just love, you know, like when a ladybug lands on you and you get so excited. And then, you know, one of those white moths that lay all those eggs that eat your broccoli. And then you don't get so excited about those. And, you know, just the values that we put on the bugs that are there and not there. And I think, like, just like Jackie and then Kathy before and also Deb, it's the questioning that I think is really valuable because we have the answers inside of ourselves. The precepts are, they really invite you, I think, to be asking those questions of where do you come out? What's valuable? What's most important in your life? So I'm glad that many of you are asking those kind of questions. Anyone else?
I had a recent experience where I really, really misunderstood something.
and was once again just blown away. And I thought that boundaries were you know, being, you know, whatever the word is, that they weren't being respected and all this and that. And I was making up this huge story. And it was once again, this has happened to me so many times in the past, you know, few years since I started this practice, that I was just blown away by my ignorance of the situation. Mm-hmm. Just blown away. Absolutely. It was almost like a shock to the system when I finally realized just how far off the mark I was. So, you know, I think everything is boundaries. It just seems like everything is boundaries in a way. Like it's all the same. And then when I go even deeper with it, it's sort of like, it's really, it's all love. And if we, you know, and then so after I have this shockwave of ignorance, I have to like, I'm better at it now, much better at it, that, you know, it's not even I have to like say, oh, I have to have compassion for myself now because I did this. It's just there. It's just there. And I'm allowed to move on. And that's, but there's still a huge shockwave. And I think, and that's great. It's good because it's embodying that horrible feeling of, and remembering the next time, you know, maybe, maybe I need to like really, you know, just pause and ask questions, you know, not just jump to conclusions. So yeah, thanks. I loved your talk. Thank you.
Cheryl, thank you so much for sharing that, because I don't know if there's anyone here on either Zoom or in the room who would not say, oh yeah, done that, been there. And I think what's beautiful about allowing yourself to really feel the shockwave of the full awareness of that ignorance is that's what melts the ice in the heart. You know, because you did that, oh right, and I've done that, oh, and he did that. And it just, I think there's a kind of softening, you know, our humanity and the humility that we bring to the practice, and the willingness to just own up to it. You know, it's like, you know, we all had whatever kind of childhoods we had, and we had the parents we had and whatever. But then we get to be grown-ups, and we're responsible for what it is, for what's there, even if we didn't like how it got there, you know? And so how did we get to be jumping to a conclusion and all of that? But we did. And so then that there's a beauty in it, even though I hear also the pain of it, that shockwave. And then, you know, in some ways it's like, oh my goodness, and what does the other person think too? You know, there's so many parts to that. And here we are together in that, you know, the shockwave. And the very, you know, 2 years ago when we did dependent origination, the very first doorway, the very first thing is ignorance. It's part of what, it's part of our DNA as along with everything else, I guess, you know. And so when we see it, I know it could sound a little sappy to say it's beautiful, but I really think it is. I think it's that one of those big steps of allowing the heart to become more tender, and the judgment just softens a bit. So onward, huh? Isn't that something? How we just keep doing it. And like you say, next time, you know, because you have the intention to pause and ask questions, and did I understand you right? Is that what you said? And here's the way.
You have the freedom to feel that it's here after you do that.
Yeah. It's, some people, you know, they think, wow, why do you do this? Why do you spend all this time, you know, meditating and in Dharma sessions and reading suttas and studying and listening to talks and stuff? And I think this is why. This is why. Because what freedom means in a lot of ways is those moments of just seeing the truth of it. of like, you know, my ignorance in this moment created such a barrier and so much difficulty and gave me the incentive to listen better, pause more, you know, all the things we learn in the practice. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. That's one of the beautiful things of Sangha, I think, too, is that we practice those, that precept, the one that I made first, of being not telling lies to ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't misunderstand because they said it wrong.
Right.
If they had said it right, I would have gotten it, right? That's the old way. That's the way we used to understand it, right? Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Anyone else? Emery. Hi, I'll turn off my microphone so you can.
Thanks. Hi. So I'm just thinking about a boundary that I kind of put up in the past couple of years over the course of the pandemic with my mom. And, you know, it's like in my body, it felt right. And it continues to feel like an appropriate boundary to have that, kind of protects my capacity and my energy. And, I don't know, it makes me sad, but it feels okay for now. And it does feel flexible. It doesn't feel like, okay, this is set in stone and we're going to have this distance forever. When you went through your four sort of characteristics of a healthy and wholesome boundary, like, does it align with my values? That's such a toughie, because like my values would be to be connected in a really deep and caring way with all the people I love in my life. And then the one about, does it create connection or disconnection? I mean, it creates connection with myself and with other people in my life who need my energy, but it obviously doesn't create connection with her right now, even though, you know, that might benefit her. And is it based in my practice? It's like part of me feels like, okay, if I were really like a really awesome Buddhist or a really awesome practitioner, I would find a way to be connected with her right now, even though it would be really hard. And other things in my life would have to suffer maybe, or let go of. So I guess when I distill it all down, it's kind of like, I'm not understanding the ways that you could have a healthy boundary with someone that you love and are supposed to love when that boundary's like, you know what? We need to have a little more space and a little, like, I can't give as much to you right now, or I can't be in the same role with you that we've been in for all these years, because I have to have some sort of self preservation. So that was a lot, and I don't know if it made sense.
It totally makes sense, and thank you for sharing that, Emery. Healthy, beneficial boundaries can sometimes feel really sad. Also, like you were just saying, and you also said that it's, you know, you're going to keep looking at it to see if at some point that can change.
And, you know, there's so many nuances in these four principles, you know, like you were saying about it allows for better connection with yourself and what's really healthy and beneficial for you. And you even implied that it might be beneficial for her too. It's just not an easy thing. I remember many years ago, my son was in his mid-20s and needed to not have any communication for a while. And I was just devastated. And, you know, he felt that Bill and I weren't treating him as an adult, and we were doing too many things that were keeping him as a kid, and all of that. And it was really painful. And in retrospect, I think it was an important thing that he needed to do. And when we reconnected, we had some space to talk about, well, what did he need in order to feel like we were treating him as an adult? And we just kept our mouths shut in terms of the thoughts of, well, if you acted more like an adult, you know, that kind of thing that parents do. And we never said it, you know, except to each other. And so sometimes painful boundaries can be beneficial. And I'm sorry that it's being so hard on you right now, but it sounds like you're using some really good discernment and asking the questions. And I wish I had some kind of magic bullet for you, but I don't. Yeah, I think it's a very real conundrum that a lot of us make, especially with family members. There are times when a little distance is really what is needed. Now, you don't want to do it forever and keep looking at it. Thanks, Emery. One last little quick one and then give it over to Iris. Oh, yes, please. You want to come up and use the microphone? Okay, I'm not sure I can hear you. He asked, do I have any thoughts about, I guess, people who lack boundaries, or times when we lack boundaries? And I certainly have experienced that again in families. I think a lot of times there's this expectation that we're a family, so, you know, we love everybody. And we don't always. So I think some of the lack of boundaries is because we're confronted with those rules or those established boundaries from other people. I wondered whether you have some insight as to the lack of boundaries in maybe your own life. Oop, coming up to the microphone.
No, I can't ask you to repeat that. I think for me personally, it might be fear of rejection, fear of being labeled. I hear the word fear coming up a lot. But something associated with fear that then you kind of, or I kind of then will like, okay, I'm just going to kind of lower my standards or something, and maybe allow behavior that isn't so skillful, and in a sense is kind of like dropping a boundary layer that maybe should be there. Like in a sense of like, if a boundary is like standing up for yourself, you know, mm-hmm. that's kind of maybe a form of boundary. So I think that's about.
And if it's a boundary that you feel that you need to establish with somebody who's not being respectful of your boundaries, and yet you're hesitant to do it because you don't want to then be judged by this other person.
I think that's a great summary. Yeah.
Okay. And I, again, I think a lot of us have found that sometimes playing it out playing out with somebody else, you know, what would be the worst thing that you would do to me? You know, you do this with a friend that you're good with, you know, there's so-and-so who really, you know, is like, does all these things that doesn't respect, they don't respect my boundaries, and play out what would happen and really look at some of that fear. In a safe environment with a Dharma sibling, maybe, or with just a good friend. And really examine the fear. You know, one of the things I said in my talk was that sometimes the fear, it can be so ego-based. And if we allow the precepts and the sila to be a little bit more on the upper tier, it can help us to look at how important is this fear. What would really happen if the person just said, well, you're an oh so-and-so, and I don't want anything to do with you, and I'm going to tell everybody I know about you. Well, what would really happen if that was what was going on? And so that, again, the investigation of a fear, those who sit with me on Sunday mornings know that I talk a lot about it because it's been such a huge part of my life. And I've been lately approaching fear as a friend that I've known for a long time, and fear has known me for a long time. And we kind of explore stuff together. And I've tried to have a little softer relationship with fear as I investigate it. But it's a bigger topic, and I wish I had more time to sit and chat with you about it, but I promised Iris I would give her plenty of time. Thank you for raising that. And thanks to everybody.